Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 26th of February, these are our main stories. Votes are being counted in Nigeria after a tight presidential election race. Russia has blamed the West for disrupting the G20 finance ministers' meeting in India, which failed to issue a joint statement because of a disagreement over the war in Ukraine. Turkish officials say they're now investigating more than 600 people over buildings that collapsed during the deadly earthquakes 3 weeks ago. Also in this podcast,
it's that culture and that music, that ceremonies that brings the fishermen together.
The musician and environmental campaigner Baba Maal on his new album and climate change. People in Nigeria have been voting in the country's most closely contested presidential and parliamentary elections in recent history. The candidates of the two parties that have long dominated the political scene, Bola Tinubu and Atiku Abubakar, are facing a challenge from Peter Obi, a former governor who's used social media to capture the support of young people. On Saturday, some polling stations opened late, some stayed closed. These voters in the city of Lagos, though, said they were confident that the election would be free and fair.
We are here to decide our next president for the next 4 years. So whatever we decide right now will affect us positively or negatively in the next 4 years. So I just hope we all do the right thing and vote wisely. The general election is going to be a free and fair one.
The effort INEC has been putting in place, with the way they are doing things, the incentivization they have been giving to people, I think the election is going to be free and fair.
Well, the ballots are now being counted. I heard more from the BBC's Peter Okwoche, who's in Abuja.
It was a chaotic start to the day. I mean, I went out as early as 6 o'clock in the morning. Polls didn't open until 8:30, but even at 8:30, some polling units didn't have any ballot papers or ballot boxes or even election officials. It took a while, and then, you know, we're going into the swing of things, but there were still delays. There's this new machine that is used to verify voters. Some of them had problems. And at some polling stations, there were really, really long queues. And at other polling stations just nearby, you'd find, you know, just a trickle of people coming in. So it has been chaotic, but Nigerians have been resilient and they have been patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And we heard a few of them earlier on saying, look, we think it's going to be free and fair. They have faith in the system. What about the presidential race, though? It seems to be very, very closely fought. Remind us, though, about the main candidates.
You're right. It's a very tight race. I mean, it'd take a very brave person to even hazard a guess as to who would win these polls. Now, as you mentioned earlier on, traditionally, there are two main political parties that have dominated Nigeria's elections for the last 24 years, the ruling APC and then the PDP, which was in power at some point for 16 years. The ruling party's candidate is Bola Ahmed Tinubu, a former governor of Lagos State, a very extremely wealthy man. He's 70 years old. He is credited with bringing President Buhari into power 8 years ago. Now, he says it's his turn to become president, has a lot of support in the Southwest. Then the main opposition candidate, Atiku Abubakar, who was vice president of Nigeria from 1999 to 2007. Another very powerful, wealthy politician. But both have been challenged by Peter Obi, who, as you said, has used social media to garner the support of young people who say they need change to happen in Nigeria and they get a leader that they deserve.
That was Peter Okwoche in Nigeria. Well, staying on the African continent, and his fans had to wait 7 years for a new album. But now the Senegalese musician Baba Maal has released his latest work. Maal is probably one of the most famous African musicians outside his country. And throughout his long career, he's often found inspiration for his work in the traditional fishing community in which he was raised. His new album, Being, comes at a time when the fishermen of Senegal face mounting challenges as a result of climate change, as Joe Robinson reports.
Mm-hmm. Being is an album between two rivers. The opening track, Yeremiah Celebration, pays tribute to the traditional culture of the Senegalese fishermen, the occupation of Baba Maal's father, and one he may very likely have pursued if the dream of becoming a musician hadn't taken hold. It celebrates their relationship to their environment, the River Senegal on the country's northern border, and the balance they've achieved with the river through traditional practices of generations.
It's that culture and that music, that ceremonies that brings the fishermen together and make them strong. And when they are strong, they will rise up their voices.
The traditional fishermen of Senegal do face mounting pressures as the ecosystems they rely upon are impacted by climate change. At the mouth of the Senegal River sits the former trading centre of Saint-Louis. In recent years, the rise in commercial fishing and weather events linked to climate change has depleted stock and flooded coastal districts.
The coastal erosion and the sea level rise are causing a lot of destruction in the historical fishing neighbourhoods.
This is Professor Mamadou Dime, expert in climate migration at the University of Saint-Louis.
There are entire communities that are being forced to move from the areas. The community that has been impacted the most by illegal migration, with people living on boats to reach Spain, is the fishing community.
It's a danger not lost on the legendary Senegalese musician.
When you go at the coast, you see things changing. For example, in Saint Louis, you see some of the land, some of the houses that was near the ocean, they're just disappearing in the ocean. The people have to be displaced. And the young people want to do something. They really want to do something.
Even though they're leaving in significant number, Maal has optimism that youth organization and passion for climate issues amongst those that remain is a reason for hope. It's a passion he's taken an active part in supporting. In 2005, Maal founded the Blues to Fleuve Festival on the banks of the Senegal. A celebration of African music has become a forum for addressing issues like climate change.
The last festival that I organized at the north of Senegal, I saw at least 20 young people who came from 20 different countries, and they came to Podor. They meet all the students that are from this part of Senegal, and they spend days and days to talk together and to say Africa clean, Africa green.
In contrast to the torrential energy of the opener, the final track, Casamance Nights, flows slowly. The Casamance Basin dominates Senegal, south of the Gambia, and the song conveys the roar of the river as a source of timeless peace in a region troubled by both environmental and political strife. Regardless of the challenges posed, Maal is confident that the resilience of the Senegalese fishermen, their sense of being, cannot be overcome.
That report was by Joe Robinson. Russia has accused Western countries of destabilising the G20 finance ministers meeting in India by trying to include references to Ukraine in the joint closing statement. The ministers failed to agree the statement, with the hosts, India, saying that Russia and China had objected to parts of the document condemning Russian aggression. Instead, India, as current G20 president, issued its own summary of the gathering. The US and UK wanted to reaffirm their support for Kyiv and push for sanctions. Spain's Minister for the Economy, Nadia Calviño, expressed similar views.
Discussions are getting more difficult as the war goes on. I think thanks to the good work of the Indian presidency, we are making progress on the different open issues. And concerning the reference to the war and the need to have, as soon as possible, put an end to this war and bring back peace in Ukraine, the approach of the Spanish government is one where we have to maintain the language that was agreed by our leaders in Bali.
Our correspondent Leila Natu sent this report from Bangalore.
India has been determined to use its presidency of the G20 to champion the needs of developing nations. In his opening address to finance ministers and central bank governors who'd gathered here in Bangalore, Prime Minister Modi urged delegates to focus on the most vulnerable citizens of the world. India wanted to discuss debt burdens, food security, and sustainable growth. But the conversation became dominated by divisions over the war in Ukraine. India has remained neutral on the conflict, but the UK and US came to the meeting to reaffirm their support for Ukraine, to strongly condemn Russia and to push for economic sanctions. But Russian and Chinese delegations objected to any reference to the war being included in a final statement. India said the two countries believed it wasn't for finance ministers and central bank governors to get into political issues. So no jointly agreed document was published. Instead, India issued its own summary of the event, saying most members strongly condemned the war and demanded Russia's withdrawal from Ukraine.
Leila Nattu in the Indian city of Bangalore. In Germany, when the Green Party campaigned in the general election just months before the Russian attack on Ukraine, they did so under the slogan, "No weapons to any war zone." Well, now that they're part of the coalition government, they've become the most vociferous supporters of sending tanks and other weapons to help Ukrainians defend themselves. But the matter is dividing public opinion in Germany, with many people fearing an escalation of the war and direct German involvement. On Saturday, thousands of people demonstrated in the centre of Berlin against sending more weapons to Ukraine. Our correspondent Jenny Hill was there.
They have come here in their thousands to the heart of the city centre through some pretty nasty weather conditions. And they're here because they want to demand the end of the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. And they want an immediate start to peace negotiations. That is not the current strategy of the German government, of course. All of this has been organised by a couple of women, one of whom is actually on the stage behind me now, addressing the crowds. They have started an online petition with those demands. That's gathered well over 600,000 signatures so far. Germany, of course, is a very particular country when it comes to foreign policy of this kind. For so long, this country has considered itself to have a special responsibility following the atrocities committed in its name during World War II. Its foreign policy has been, for decades, one focused very much around pacifism, looking for negotiation, trading links, rather than any kind of active involvement in military conflict. A year ago, it would have been unthinkable for this country to send weapons into an active war zone. That is now what it's doing. And I mentioned the demographic of the people here. They are, by and large, middle-aged and older. These are people who for decades have been used to that kind of pacifist outlook. In the space of a year, all of that has been turned on its head. Germany is now a country really profoundly considering its own role on the world stage, with a particular view to its military role on the world stage. There's a lot of change going on, big debate going on today, and a lot of people turning out to make their views on the current situation very clear indeed.
Jenny Hill in Berlin. People have, of course, been the biggest victims of Russia's war in Ukraine, with thousands killed on both sides and millions of Ukrainians displaced by the conflict. But humans are not the only casualties. The UN's cultural agency, UNESCO, has warned that Russia is deliberately targeting things of cultural, linguistic, historical or religious significance in Ukraine. It says that it may be a deliberate attempt to erase Ukrainian identity and has called for such targeting to stop. Milena Cherna is the deputy director of the National Museum of the History of Ukraine in the Second World War in Kyiv. She started by telling Julian Warka how the museum has been collecting items from the current war.
Started in March when everyone went to make photo shoots of what was going on in the Kyiv region. But then the team switched to go into the deoccupied territories. For instance, Chernihiv region, it's slightly more to the north. And they spent 2 weeks collecting artifacts like armor, whatever was left after Russian soldiers, for instance, shoes. We have food. They brought here from Russia these huge cans with soup. And for some reason unknown, they put the slogan, "Leave no man behind," on a pea soup. The present exhibition is located on three floors. In the first floor, it's what was left from Russian troops. It's called the Horde. The second floor is cultural heritage, actually Ukraine crucifixion. We display icons that have been shot down, you know, shot through. They've been used as targets for shooting practice. Icons from ruined churches, whatever we were able, you know, to save. And the underground is dedicated to the bomb shelter. It's a documented site.
Has the building been hit at all by any of the bombing?
Thankfully, no. One of the reasons, I believe, is that we are located right next to Chukiv Pechersk Lavra. It used to be the main location of Russian priests, and I believe they were scared of hitting their own. So for now, I believe we are more or less safe.
I wanted to ask you as well about the wider picture and the suggestion that the culture of Ukraine has been to an extent targeted by the Russians in this war. The UN's culture agency, UNESCO, talked of more than 240 cultural properties having been damaged in Ukraine over the last year. How conscious are you of that?
When we were helping museum workers, you know, you get the information even from the occupied territories. But I have to say that none of us have the full picture, not even the government, I believe so, because we have little information from the occupied regions. For instance, Stone Grave, one of the oldest archaeological sites in Ukraine, I know it's been all mined, and I'm not sure in what state it is, and no one knows, because it's on occupied territories. But that they are targeting cultural heritage, that's for sure. And for example, there's, you know, this case when we had wanted to celebrate 300 years anniversary of one of our most famous philosophers. And they hit his National Literary Memorial Museum, absolutely direct. But the thing is, it's in an old estate, in a small village, and there's no infrastructure at all, not even civilian infrastructure. So it was absolutely targeted. And it was obvious. There's one of the aspects, you know, whether we should put the blue shield mark on the sites.
When you say the blue shield, what difference would that make in practice?
Well, at least when the building is destroyed, at least we could proceed with the criminal court, you know, that they knew what they were targeting.
It would mark it out as a place of cultural significance.
But at the same time, they would know as well that it's something valuable. Many museum workers are being kidnapped because sometimes Russian soldiers want to know where the collection is hidden. And another reason is they really want to engage museum workers in order to work by their side, because museum workers are really cherished, especially in regions, in small towns. You know, they're well-respected. They have the authority.
That was Milena Cherna, the deputy director of the National Museum of the History of Ukraine in the Second World War. Still to come.
The thing about the Bake Off tent is that it's the perfect vessel. It's a fantastic precinct location for people of many different backgrounds and ages to come together.
Get your rolling pins and aprons at the ready. The popular television programme is taking to the stage. Turkish officials say they're now investigating more than 600 people in connection with buildings that collapsed during major earthquakes earlier this month. Orlando Teal reports.
Turkey's Justice Minister Bekir Bozdar outlined the scale of the investigations during a visit to an earthquake coordination centre in the southeast of the country. He said that of 612 suspects under judicial investigation, 184 were already in jail, including construction contractors and building owners. More than 50,000 people are known to have died in the quakes in southern Turkey and northern Syria, and experts believe poor construction standards played a significant role. Opposition parties have accused President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's government of failing to enforce building regulations.
Orlando Teal. Well, some 50,000 people are known to have died in the earthquakes which struck Turkey and Syria on February the 6th. While international help has been arriving, many survivors have complained that aid and rescue efforts were slow and left thousands freezing on the streets without shelter. Our correspondent Laura Bicker and her team report on the ground now and in the air in southeastern Turkey on the challenges of getting help to those who need it.
aid that took time to arrive is now in full flow. Tents, food, medicine are all passed along a line of soldiers and volunteers, then crammed on board flight after flight. More than 100 aircraft leave here every day. Our helicopter is stacked full before we take off over the mountains to get an idea of the scale of this disaster.
This is by far the biggest logistical operation Turkish forces have ever faced. The fault line that they're having to cover is over 100 kilometres long. 10 cities are in a state of emergency, and then there are remote communities scattered across the mountain. And the biggest thing people need right now are these tents. And it takes up a bit of room in a helicopter.
On the southern coast, in the hillside village of Kabusuyu, they've waited for more than 2 weeks for tents. Hamza Sevar told us shelters have finally arrived after yet another big tremor on Monday.
Our water is disconnected. We have no electricity. Our situation is dire. We can't communicate. Our phones have no signal inside the village. We don't know what's next. Will they build houses? Will they demolish our homes? Will they take us elsewhere? We don't know what we will do.
Gonul shows us around her house. It's still standing, just. But the cracked concrete means the roof over her bedroom is at an angle. It's not safe.
We live in fear. We can't sleep well at night. When the quake happens, we suddenly wake up. What can we do? We can't go outside either. It's cold. There's nothing that can be done.
Her daughter was killed when the first earthquake struck the city of Antakya on February the 6th. They've buried her here in the village. The tents are temporary. Gonal told us she needs a new home. There have been major challenges to overcome to help people like Gonal. Airports are damaged and landing in remote areas has been difficult.
Guys have been flying over 1,000 hours since this earthquake. They say they've been going non-stop. And one of the things they've been telling us is the view they had as they first flew into the earthquake-affected areas, the casualties that they had to evacuate. Some of them have incredibly harrowing stories, and they're still keeping going.
Aid is now getting to most who need it, but this operation is a short-term fix. The long-term plan to help the tens of thousands of people left homeless in this crisis is still unclear.
Laura Bicker in Turkey. The British government and the European Union appear to be on the brink of finalising a new deal on post-Brexit trading rules for Northern Ireland. The Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, said there was a possibility of a deal in the next few days, but it was by no means guaranteed. Our political correspondent, Ione Wells, reports.
The essence of a new deal between the UK and the EU over trading arrangements for Northern Ireland is basically there. Discussions between both sides are now focusing on how it is unveiled and presented. The government is briefing politicians and business stakeholders about it. Critics are concerned that politicians in Northern Ireland may still not get full control over future EU laws that could apply there. The government knows this may be a case of giving everyone some things they need if you can't give anyone everything they want.
Ione Wells. Two brothers from Pakistan who were held in the US military prison at Guantanamo Bay for nearly 20 years have been released without charge. Abdul and Mohammed Ahmed Rabbani were arrested in Pakistan in 2002. The Pentagon said Abdul Rabbani operated an Al-Qaeda safe house whilst his brother organised travel and funds for the group's leaders. The brothers alleged that they were tortured by CIA officers before being transferred to Guantanamo. Both have now been repatriated to Pakistan. They were represented by Clive Stafford Smith, a human rights lawyer with the 3D Centre, and he's been speaking to my colleague Michelle Hussein about the case.
It's an incredibly traumatic thing, of course. They both spent 540 days being tortured in the dark prison in unspeakable ways. So, you know, I'd be flip if I said that they're fine. They're facing a really long, difficult, tough climb out of Guantanamo Bay.
When you say tortured in a dark prison, do you mean before they got to Guantanamo, or were they tortured in Guantanamo?
It's called the dark prison, and it was rather notorious in Guantanamo, in Kabul, in Afghanistan. And, you know, we have a lot of information on that, unfortunately, now that's come out through the Senate. And it all happened because Ahmed Rabbani was sold for a bounty, $5,000, with the tag saying that he was an evil terrorist called Hassan Gul, who was quite notorious. And what we discovered, and it was about 12 years ago, we discovered that actually the US captured Hassan Gul, brought him to the same dark prison, and then because he cooperated, unlike Ahmed, who refused to say he was Hassan Gul, they set him free. And he went back to his wicked ways and got droned in 2012, and Ahmed went to Guantanamo Bay.
Can you be sure that neither of the brothers were ever involved with Al-Qaeda?
Well, yes, I can be sure. But on the other hand, it's not really me you should be listening to. It took all six of the top US intelligence agencies to clear them. And the real problem is why they didn't do that years ago. And if you want me to speculate, I can't prove this, but it's really because they were such an embarrassment that, you know, we'd held them there for 20 years, really, when they were total nobodies. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, whereas, in fact, we'd let the real guy go.
Do you think they are eligible for some kind of compensation? What normally happens when people are released from Guantanamo in circumstances like this, where it seems they were, from what you're saying, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Well, it's terribly sad. I think, you know, they won't get compensation from the US. We have a crowdfunder to try to, you know, fund them a new house, a place to live and so forth. But really, the issue here is they'll never even get an apology. It always makes me think of Elton John, that sorry seems to be the hardest word.
And where does it take the numbers in Guantanamo Bay to? And do you have other clients still there?
We're down to 34. Of the 34, another 16 are cleared. And I certainly intend to carry on trying until we close that place down. It's a stain on the reputation of America for human rights.
Clive Stafford-Smith, a human rights lawyer with the 3D Centre. Next to Australia, and Anthony Albanese has become the first serving Australian Prime Minister to march in the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras in Sydney, one of the biggest global events of its kind. His arrival was greeted by cheers. He told the crowd that it was a celebration of a diverse and inclusive modern Australia and said the fight for equality must continue.
Australia's an inclusive country and there are benefits for our economy. There are benefits, most importantly though, for the people of Australia, and that everyone should be respected for who they are. And tonight's a celebration of that, and it's a great example of what an amazing country this is.
Critics of the Prime Minister accuse him of pandering to a minority trying to hijack Australia's social agenda. A passion for baking is the prime ingredient. Add a large amount of fierce competition with contestants leaving every week, all under an eye-catching tent. And you have the perfect recipe for a production that has gripped the British nation for more than 12 years now. And the television concept has been exported to at least 30 countries around the world, from Morocco to Uruguay. Now the show has been transformed into an all-singing, all-dancing spectacle on the stage. Bake Off the Musical opened in London on Saturday. Before that crisp, short crust, swirling icing event, we spoke to one of the writers, Jake Brunger.
The thing about the Bake Off tent is that it's the perfect vessel. It's a fantastic precinct location for people of many different backgrounds and ages and sexualities and classes to come together and show not just the skill they have for baking, but about how their friendship develops between them, which is just, that's an ultimately musical theatre story. There's always normally a sort of elder granny type who bakes for her grandchildren, and there's always a pretty young girl who studies at Cambridge University. But I knew that in this show, I could dig into some quite serious various subjects as well. My sister was widowed when she was 29, and she joined a baking group where she met a widowed man who she fell in love with. And I've managed to sneak that storyline into the show. So it's really about how grief and bereavement sort of draws these people together.
So it really is Big Tent.
Yes,
and you actually
much.
Have a tent that is almost like the Bake Off tent on the stage with the bunting and everything.
Of course, and it lights up. It does very clever things.
But if my dad was on your show, I know he would kill it. People say he's a baking pro, so he'd definitely win it. But he needs a makeover. Bake Off, please take over. Stop him from wearing his denim and plaid.
So tell us about some of these songs. There's 16 of them, which is quite a lot.
Yeah, there's a character called Izzy in a song called Obviously, where she talks about her sort of secret inner desire to win.
Always the straightest student, I don't come in second place. If there's a marathon, believe me, I'm gonna win that race. No one.
There's lots of lovely, like, fun duets. There's Big Company numbers. We've done something much more heartfelt and real and just life-affirming.
That was Jake Brungas talking to Rajini Vaidyanathan. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. Before we go, though, here's a word from my colleague Andrew Peach.
Yes, you know we love hearing from you on the Global News podcast, and I wonder if you can help us out with something new. We'd like to hear about the sound you really love. Could be a piece of music, could be a sound from the natural environment in your part of the world, the sound of children in your family enjoying themselves, or maybe something really simple like the sound of making a cup of coffee. Drop us an email to tell us about the sound and why it makes you happy. globalnews@bbc.co.uk. And if you can record it on your phone and send it to us as a voice note, even better. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. We can't wait to hear it.
And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email using the same address. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Paul Mason. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast that brings you extraordinary personal stories from around the world. Each week, we invite listeners inside the most intimate and defining moments of our guests' lives. Like the man who went to North Korea, posing as a fake billionaire to expose North Korea's illicit arms trade.
There's nowhere to run, and I'm just trying to look as cool as I can.
The woman who took on Nigeria's military dictatorship in the 90s. Her father is believed to have won the presidency in a democratic election, but he'd been imprisoned by the regime.
He was doing an interview with the BBC just as he was being arrested. And you could hear in his voice this sense that the problems that he was facing were going to be easily resolved, but he never came out alive.
And the boxing champion who spent his teen years on the run from the law with his father.
I don't ask questions, I just do. Come on, I need you guys to pack up your bags. We get fake IDs. Into Mexico we go.
For more incredible stories like these, search for Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.